Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Noah Stricker, associate editor of Birding Magazine and Hardcore Birder. And we're talking about his new book, Birding Without Borders, An Obsession, A Quest, and the Biggest Year in the World. Noah, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mark.
So you decided that in the year 2015, you were going to do something really insane. And that was to try to see as many birds in the world as you could. Now, people had tried this before, and I want to mention, I think it was Peter Alden, who was from here in Massachusetts. Did he do that intentionally, or just they rack up all those birds in the year 2000 in 1968? Because he was just traveling around the world birding, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's right. I think Peter Alden was just birding and ended up racking up a whole bunch of species along the way when he was birding in the 50s. But he was one of the first real world birders
to
get outside of the U.S. and see some of these exotic species.
And then there was James Clement, the ornithologist, who in 1989 racked up 3,600 species. And finally, Alan Davies and Ruth Miller in 2008 rack up 4,300 species. So that's the number you're going for, 4,300 species of birds in a year. Now, talk to me about the preparation and the planning that you had to put into this. How long did the planning and prep take?
Well, yeah, you know, big years have been around for a while, since the 50s, but mostly on a continental scale where people are trying to see as many birds as they can in one year. And this was one of the first efforts to really do that worldwide. And so there were no rules in terms of how to put this kind of trip together, and it was logistically challenging. How do you go find as many birds as humanly possible in 365 days on planet Earth? I ended up deciding that this would be as local in scope as possible, even though it was an international trip. And so I made two rules for myself from the beginning. I said I would have to find every bird with at least one other person, which would incidentally give me witnesses for all these sightings.
And for people who are not...
Locals living in the same country.
Yeah, Noah, wait a minute. Slow down. For people who aren't birders, why would it be important to have a witness to what you saw, he said, straight-lining him?
Birding is pretty much on the honor system. It's not like you're out proving a court case. It's more of a personal journey and a personal quest. So there's no reason to really make it up. But
people do.
Once in a while, there are cases, and there is actually a word for somebody who makes up their sightings. It's called a stringer.
Yeah.
That's like the worst insult you can say to a birder. You're a stringer.
That's from Bill Oddie's book, The Little Black Book, isn't it?
It is kind of a British term, but it's Americans know what it means, too.
So you wanted a witness, and then you also relied a lot, almost exclusively, on local guides to bring you around.
Yeah, that's right. There's nothing that can replace local knowledge. And so I was essentially calling people up halfway around the world and saying, hey, I'm doing a big year. Can I come crash on your couch for a couple of days? And do you want to go birding?
Now, reading this account of this, what's amazing to me is how close everything was. So that if there was a screw up in a plane, there was almost like a domino effect of problems happening. You really cut it very close.
Yeah, there was a case where I was trying to get out of New York State, and my next planned layover was in Iceland. But I only had one day in Iceland, and I was delayed by good old United Airlines getting 27 hours late out of New York. So that pretty much wiped out my whole planned layover in the next country. So that can happen, but overall, everything went remarkably smoothly, I think.
I think you were amazing. You had an amazing amount of luck that things didn't screw up more. The other thing is you had to choose countries and locations within countries where you're going to be able to maximize the number of species that you saw. So, in fact, you didn't bird a lot in Europe and North America at all. And you have to explain why to people who aren't birders.
In general, the greatest biodiversity is found in the tropics. The closer you get to the equator, the more bird species there are. And so I had to spend about three-quarters of my year in these tropical jungles, essentially, trying to track down as many birds as I could. And then when I came through the U.S. and Europe, first of all, the infrastructure is much better, so you can sweep through the territory a lot faster. And there's just not as many species. I think all of the U.S. has about 700 bird species. Compare that to something like Ecuador, the size of Colorado, has 1,800.
But, Noah, what totally shocked me is you started out where?
I did start in Antarctica.
Which way? Well, that has
January 1st.
That's got the fewest number of species.
If you're going to see the world, you might as well start at the end of it.
But it's got the fewest number of species anywhere.
Strategically, Antarctica is about the worst place you can go to find bird species. And I guess by starting there, I also kind of wanted to make this subtle statement from the beginning that, yeah, my goal was to find 5,000 birds, but it wasn't just about the numbers, because birding is, of course, so much more. It's about the people you're out there with and the adventures and misadventures along the way. So the listing was the motivation to get out the door, and once I was out there, just enjoying the journey.
Talk to me about packing. Now, you have to pack down, this packing thing down to a science. What were the essentials that you brought on every single trip?
Well, I think I learned how to pack from hiking the Pacific Crest Trail, a long backpacking trail, a few years ago. And so for this trip, I just took one small backpack that was small enough to slide under the seat of any airplane, so I'd never have to check any luggage. I did need to take a spotting scope and a tripod to see the birds well, so that left just enough room around the edges for, you know, an extra pair of underwear and some malaria medication and water purification tablets and not that much else, because it's really true that the farther you go, the less you really need to take with you along the way.
And how is food? You know, when I read about, and I've traveled around too, I was amazed you didn't come down with weird stuff more, or did you not just write about that? You did get really sick at one point, and you just sort of like totally exhausted. I think your pace had sort of gotten the better of your body.
Yeah.
But you didn't seem to get any kind of like classic traveler's diarrhea or anything, or did you?
I got sick twice. I got the flu in Peru, I think exhaustion related, and I got Delhi belly in India for a day pretty viciously, which was well worth it because the food there was amazing. But other than that, yeah, I didn't really have any major health issues, which I think is fortunate because that's the one thing that really could have slowed me down.
So talk to me about communicating and getting this all set up. The amazing thing is doing it now in the 21st century, a lot of it can be done through the internet. I was just talking to Victor Emmanuel, and he was talking about setting up trips back in the 50s and the 60s, where you had to like write letters to get people to like know that you were there. But you were pretty trusting. You would fly into an airport, and you would know that the person was going to meet you there, right?
It's amazing how birders have connected with each other just in the past 10 or 15 years with the internet and email and phones bringing people together more. And so this trip wouldn't have even been possible in remotely the same way a couple decades ago, never mind the 1950s.
Oh my God.
And so, yeah, I was able to, just by word of mouth and websites like Birding Pal and eBird, track down birders in all these far-flung places and send them a message, and that's how I made my contacts.
And you also kept a blog as you went.
Yeah, every day I wrote a blog entry at the end of the day, often at like 1 o'clock in the morning. But that was really fun to see how that built and people started following along. I started it as a way to tell my mom and dad that I wasn't quite dead yet, you know. By the end, it was getting tens of thousands of views a day. So people really took an interest.
Did you rack up a lot of frequent flyer miles while doing this?
Unfortunately, I flew on basically every carrier known to this planet, so I didn't get many miles on any single one of them, and I didn't get status anywhere.
So you couldn't like sort of turn this trip into a collection of other trips later on.
That's right.
Oh, no. That's really too bad. Now, were there certain key birds, you know, you're going to do this, and I know what it's like to do any kind of big birding trip. Were there certain key birds in all of this global thing that you really, really, as a birder, wanted to see?
Well, sure. In the context of a big year,
like what was your number one?
Counts the same as a sparrow, but there's certain birds I really wanted to find. I think my number one most wanted was in South America, the bird called the harpy eagle.
Oh, yeah.
which eats monkeys and sloths as its main diet. It's 3 feet tall, just spectacular and rare. And I got a chance to see one in Brazil, so it's, that was probably the top sighting of the year.
It's enormous. First of all, and you know, you make it sound like you just went out there and sort of ticked the bird. You had to really work to get a sighting of this bird.
The harpy eagle, we found an active nest, but had to stake it out for about 6 straight hours before it finally flew in. And, you know, you don't know that it's going to arrive. And so 6 hours of sitting there, I was getting really frustrated and disappointed and every emotion you can think of. And finally, this eagle flew in. And just that rush of adrenaline, that's what keeps us birding.
Didn't it have a coati in its talons?
It did. It had this, a coati is like a raccoon-like tropical animal, and it landed on a tree in front of us and proceeded to just rip this animal apart. The full-on harpy eagle experience.
The thing is, and people have to realize, you know, waiting for 6 hours, you know, if you're just doing that, it's like I went to the country to see the harpy eagle, 6 hours ago, okay, I'll do 6 hours. But because you're on this schedule, the entire time through your mind might be going, I'm wasting 6 hours on one species when I should be listing and going other places and seeing these other birds, right?
It was hard to do these calculations, but yeah, if I was going to get to 5,000, that meant like 13.7 new birds every day, which is like one new bird every waking hour for an entire year. And so every hour you spend, you could be somewhere else looking for little brown ugly endemic birds out in the jungle. So, yeah.
Now, you seemed in the reading the account, you seemed to have a good handle on Central South American birds. But when you got to places like Africa, which you hadn't gone to a lot, you were really you're out of your water as far as identification of species, right?
I'd done some traveling before this trip, and Africa was the only continent I'd never personally visited before. And so, yeah, when I got to Africa, all of a sudden, every bird I saw was new for me. And I think I saw 1,500 plus species in a couple months in Africa, 95% of which were lifers. I'd never seen them before. Jeez. And that was almost overwhelming, just learning all these new species that I'd never had experience with before.
And talk about that experience. I love that experience. It's both frustrating and really exciting to go to a place that's so far out of where you've birded before, and there's all these sounds, and you don't know what's making them. You have no idea what they are. And you have to use the field guide a whole lot. It's a real weird experience for long-term birders to be in, put in. It's like you're starting birding again from the beginning.
Yeah, for an experienced birder, going to a place where you're not familiar with the birds, I think is like a form of time travel, because it takes you back to a time when you didn't know any of the sounds of the forest around you and remembering what that's like. I thought that was fascinating.
Oh, I know. I love that feeling. Now, you had great luck, finally, with the harpy eagle. I want you to talk to me about the Philippine eagle quest, because that was extremely frustrating. First of all, set the trip up, because you ended up going there right after a typhoon?
I was in Taiwan, and my next stop was in the Philippines. Just before I hopped on the plane, the news forecasters were saying that Typhoon Lando was going to slam into Manila a couple hours before I arrived there. And so it was really up in the air as to whether I'd even get there or not. But the plane managed to land, and
now there's also
a different island.
Yeah, but there's also a political situation going on where you were too. It was not that safe to travel.
That's right. This other island called Mindanao has since been declared martial law, actually, since I was there. But even then, the U.S. State Department was officially recommending against unnecessary travel to that region because there'd been so many kidnappings. But I had local contacts there, and they knew the lay of the land. It wasn't like I was walking into this situation blind, and they knew where to find the eagle. So I was like, all right, let's go for it.
Now, you were just that like calm about this? You have to have been nervous.
My goal was not to get shot in war zones, and there were places I avoided for that reason. But
Good goal, Noah. Yeah, that's a basic goal for everybody.
Well, not everybody. There are ornithologists that will go just about anywhere for birds, but I have my limits.
But that has to have been one of the more dangerous places that you visited at that time.
It was, yeah, and I went birding in southern Turkey along the Syrian border next to ISIS territory and in a jungle in Indonesia that was controlled by Al-Qaeda that the military was actively pursuing, and one or two other spots that were fairly sketchy. But again, in each of these places, I had local contacts who really knew where the safe spots were, and so that was much better than trying to go by the international news.
Now, the Philippine eagle is another huge raptor that also eats monkeys. But this was, I think this has to have been the most frustrating sighting of your entire year.
It was just like the harpy eagle. I spent more than half a day sitting in one spot, staring at a single patch of sky, waiting for this Philippine eagle, the world's largest raptor, to appear, because they supposedly like to soar in that valley. And finally, that afternoon, I had a couple birders with me, and we spotted a speck way out in the distance, more than a mile away. And they said, that's got to be a Philippine eagle. There's really nothing else that speck could be. But looking at it, the view I had for a couple of minutes before it finally disappeared behind another ridge was just a speck. You could barely see the shape of it. You could kind of see the behavior, how it was soaring. But for me, it just wasn't enough because I couldn't convince myself that I had seen the proper field marks, and so it did not go down on my list. And that was one of the more heartbreaking encounters during the year.
Oh, my God. But it's a testament to your the way that you were keeping your list, because I know that there are other birders who would have ticked that.
I think everyone has their definition of what they think they've seen. And for me, I really need to feel like I have personally seen all of the defining field marks of any particular bird to add it to my own list. You don't have to photograph it, but as long as you are sure what you've seen based on the things that are supposed to be able to identify that bird, then it's not enough for someone else to say, oh, that's a blah, 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 and then you just nod your head. You got to be able to look at it yourself, make your own decision.
Absolutely. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Noah Stryker. Stricker, associate editor of Birding Magazine, hardcore birder, and we're talking about his new book. It's a great memoir, Birding Without Borders, an obsession, a quest, and the biggest year in the world. Did you bring a camera with you? Was that just another piece of equipment you had to lug around?
I did bring a camera. I brought one of those super zoom type cameras that's fairly small and portable, but still has a good enough zoom to take bird photos. And just by virtue of being in the field for 365 straight days, I ended up with some pretty fun photos.
Now, you're talking about keeping your blog every night. How was the connection? Because you were in some pretty out-of-the-way places. Were you able to get connected to the internet on a fairly regular basis?
It's amazing where you can find Wi-Fi these days. I could find it at gas stations and airports and people's houses that otherwise seem to have no electricity in the middle of nowhere. I thought it was amazing that in a lot of countries, they've never really had a landline network for phones, but they have better cell service than we have here at home where I live in the U.S. because they just jumped over that whole infrastructure and gone straight for the cell phone network. So, yeah, you can find service just about anywhere these days.
Now, part of the way through your trip, you start finding out that there's a guy from Holland who is carefully tracking your progress via your blog, because he's going to do a big year the next year. Tell me about your emotional reaction to that.
Yeah, I learned about in March that there was another young man, just a couple months younger than I am, from the Netherlands, named Arjan, who had announced he was going to do a big year the following year, as soon as I finished my own. And I'd always seen this as kind of a personal quest, not trying to beat someone else's effort or be particularly competitive about it, but It was increasingly feeling like someone's sort of breathing down your neck, waiting for you to stop so that they can go out and try to beat you right after you finish. And that was an odd feeling toward the end.
Now, one of the things I want to mention about that is that he would be using a different world list than you used. You used the Clements list. He was using a European ornithological list, which actually had more species on it. And you have to explain how that can happen. How can there be two scientific lists that have different numbers of species on it?
Yeah, believe it or not, there is no single agreed-upon list of the world's bird species, and the lists are changing all the time. In the U.S., ornithologists mostly use a checklist called the Clements Checklist, while in Europe, they mostly use a separate one called the International Ornithological Congress, which actually recognizes a few hundred more species than the Americans do.
And people wondering about how that can happen is that they recognize splits, species split into other species that we would recognize only the subspecies of, and that doesn't count. For instance, I think a good example is the white-winged scoter, which they recognize three species of white-winged scoters. We only recognize one.
That's right. And to define species, the definitions are shifting these days. It used to be all the biological species concepts, the classic, if two animals can't interbreed and have fertile offspring, then that designates a species. But these days, it's more relying on DNA evidence and what's called the phylogenetic species concept, which results in a lot of species being split that in the field, you can't necessarily even tell apart. They may look exactly the same, but if they're different genetically, then increasingly those are getting defined as separate species.
It's like in the future, you're going to have to take a blood sample and run a DNA analysis before you can identify it.
That's right, and your binoculars will scan it for you and tell you what bird it is.
Now, I want to talk about your experience in India where you broke the previous world record. I'm not going to give away the ending of the book because that's another whole thing, and I want to say that to people. What we're about to tell you is not the end of the book, but you actually broke the previous world's record in India. And as you write about, world's records are really important in India. They're really into it.
If you're going to break a world record, then India is definitely the place to do it. I don't know why. They are crazy about world records in that country. Some hugely disproportionate number of submissions for the Guinness Book of World Records come from India, and they've got all their own books of records. And so when they heard that I was going to break this birdwatching world record in their country, they turned out, and it was almost like a spectator sport watching me to see what my reactions would be when I saw the record-breaking bird.
Well, it's like they saved the bird. They actually saved a really good bird for you to break the record to, too. They knew that bird was there, and it wasn't until they waited until you were close enough that they knew that that was going to be the record-breaking bird, that they showed you a really cool bird.
Yeah, there's a really bizarre bird in South India called the Sri Lanka frog mouse.
I love frog mouths. Frog mouths are
nocturnal.
Excellent.
Nocturnal. Yeah. It's kind of like an owl, but not really related. Mm-hmm. It's got a big head and a really wide mouth, hence the name. And there was a pair of them that roosted every day in a particular tree that they knew about. So as soon as I got to the record, then they were like, okay, close your eyes. We're going to take you back to this tree, and then we'll have you open your eyes, and the frog mouth will be the record-breaking bird.
Wait a minute. They didn't tell you it was a frog mouth. They had you find the bird.
That's true. That's true.
They kept going, like, there's a bird. There's a really good bird up in this tree, and you're sitting there going like, I've got to try to find it. And you did identify it.
Yes. Well, they're pretty distinctive-looking birds.
They are. But what a cool bird to break a record on.
It's nice to have interesting landmark birds. I'm glad it wasn't some common brown bird in India. But
well, that reminds me, we only have minutes left, but I want to talk about the Karamoja apalis. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, in Africa, East Africa.
You made a big deal about a very ordinary bird.
Well, because the Karamoja apalis is only found in one patch of woodland in East Africa, I really wanted to see it. And it happens to be in the Serengeti, where most other people go to look for big cats and elephants and other megafauna. So I thought it was quite ironic that instead of looking for leopards and cheetahs, I was looking for this little gray bird about the size of my thumb.
And in the log kept at the lodge, you wrote that in like huge letters, exclamation point.
Yeah, everyone else had been writing about all their elephant sightings, and I wrote in all caps, Karamoja apalis, with like 10 exclamation marks behind it.
Other than the Philippine eagle, what do you think was your biggest miss?
Probably the most common bird I missed is one called a spotted redshank, which is a pretty common European, Eurasian shorebird that I just never ran across. But by the end of the year, I missed 4,000 of the world's birds, so I guess I got to go out and track down the rest of them over the rest of my life.
Are you going to? You're not going to try another big year, are you?
this for me was a once-in-a-lifetime trip. Okay. It's not like you can turn around and go out the next year and see the other half of the world bird. It's a game of diminishing returns.
That would be incredible to try to do a year where you only look at birds that you missed the first time around. That you did that. That would be really bizarre. What a weird list that would be. How did you feel at the end of it? Were you happy to get home?
It was strange, actually. My worst fear was that I would get burned out and just hate birds by the end of doing nothing else for a whole year.
Yeah.
But it didn't happen that way. It was actually the opposite. And I think in retrospect, you have to treat birding as something more like an addiction. And if you feed an addiction, it's not going to make it go away. It just messes you up even worse than you were before. And so by the end of the year, it was actually hard to think about going back to like reality.
Okay. My guest tonight has been Noah Stricker, associate editor of Birding Magazine, hardcore birder. We've been talking about his new book, a memoir. It's just out now, Birding Without Borders, an obsession, a quest, and the biggest year in the world. Noah, it's been a real pleasure.
Well, thanks, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.